Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back a longtime guest co-host, Carol Ripley Moffitt. Carol, it's been a while, but welcome back to Your Health.
Thank you, Adam. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And on our show today, Carol, we're talking with Dr. Vivian Su, Senior Program Officer at the Program for Appropriate Technology and Health, about the global fight against cervical cancer. Not something we've spoken a lot about, but something really critically important. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yes, indeed.
Indeed. We've got some research that matters today. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about blood sugar. And are we biased, whether or not men in particular, if our blood sugars are low or high, about what we think about people who are overweight? We're going to be talking about virtual dental homes.
We're going to talk about cardiac complications from energy drinks like Monster.
And then we're going to talk about avoiding high-calorie office snacks.
Yes.
And we'll truth be told, do you ever have high-calorie office snacks?
Don't ask me.
Okay. Well, we'll truth be told in a few minutes. Well, wait. First, blood sugar and obesity. And actually, this is not what you think it's going to be. This is a study that looks at, do men who are not overweight think differently about men who are overweight? And does that matter about whether their blood sugars are high or low? Why do they care about this particular study, Carol?
Well, this was a German study, and it looked at how decisions in the workplace might be biased by what they call lean men versus those who are more rotund or corpulent.
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 I'm not a routine word in my vocabulary.
No. But they looked at, they actually had the participants, 20 men who were lean and 20 corpulent men, play these what they call economic games. And they had to do with an ultimate game about fairness, a trust game, and then a risk game. And then they judged the performance back and forth between the two sets of men.
And basically, this is like, do people who are lean make decisions about people who are overweight and essentially bias about them that would then lead to them being less likely to be hired, perhaps more often to be unemployed, and even paid less for similar work? Did they find that?
They did, indeed. In fact, they found some of this even at normal blood sugar levels. But when the lean men's blood sugar levels decreased, they found even higher incidences of this preference prejudice.
So the kind of take-home message here is we all have biases, and we need to be a little bit more aware of those biases and maybe confront them more directly and recognize that this isn't fair and we can do a better job. Speaking about more often, our next research that matters is about virtual dental homes, and should this trend be encouraged more often? What is this about?
This is a six-year study from the University of the Pacific, that looks at the possibility of offering telehealth through dental hygienists to populations who typically are underserved. So this would include schools, nursing homes, and long-term care facilities.
And particularly in rural areas, we know there's such a problem getting access to good dental care. And so this study, if it were a positive, would be really amazing. And this particular team in California has implemented this telehealth virtual dental homes in Head Start preschools, elementary schools, community centers, places that take care of people with disabilities, senior centers, and nursing homes throughout California. And I guess it's good.
It's great. In fact, here's a staggering statistic. A quarter of children finish elementary school in California without ever seeing a dentist. And that's even worse. It's like 41% of children who are eligible for the Medicare program or Medicaid program, excuse me, in California receive any dental services. So you can imagine that if those folks could be reached, what an improvement in dental health. And that's exactly what they found, that there were no adverse effects, that the dental hygienist did the cleaning. Sometimes they could fill a cavity, but then they could call in a dentist from another region to give some consultation when needed.
And at least two-thirds of the time, they were able to provide the care, and they did a lot of patient education and prevention work. This seems like a win-win, deserves more research funding, broader expansion.
And they believe that it could very easily be supported by the DentaCal system, which is a part of their Medicaid system.
Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters. And this is one, Carol, where I don't know if we're going to agree or disagree, but it's one that is of interest. And this was actually a case report. And we don't typically talk about case reports because there's not the evidence. It's just a case. But sometimes it can be an important case. And in this particular one, it's a case report about these new energy drinks, or not so new. In this particular case, it was one called a Monster, that are very kind of high caffeine energy drinks. And can they really be really harmful? And this was a cardiac or heart case.
And the reason the authors chose to write this up is because they found that there were at least 8 other cases of associated cardiovascular events linked to energy drinks. And so they were kind of adding to the evidence.
And this was actually a case of a 28-year-old man who had gone to the emergency room after developing vomiting with in his blood, vomiting blood, and found out he had a very fast heart rate and what's called atrial fibrillation. And what they found is that he had drunken 2 of these Monster drinks earlier in the day, and they were worried that this could be the cause of it. And they talk about how these Monster drinks, these energy drinks, had a total caffeine intake of 320 milligrams. And that sounds like a lot, and it is some and maybe a lot. But when we compare it to some of the common things that a lot of people do, it's not that much.
Like 3 cups of coffee.
3 cups of coffee a day.
4 sodas.
Yeah, so it makes you a little, I don't know, skeptical, dubious, possibly, but I'm not so concerned.
Well, thing, this man also, or gentleman, also drank 2 to 3 beers a day. And so as they try to look at what might cause cardiovascular disease, there's some thought that other ingredients might heighten the effects of the caffeine, and that using the energy drinks along with alcohol might also contribute to this.
Yeah, one thing I don't know if we have research on, but I can tell you anecdotally, Carol, that when patients tell me how much they drink caffeine, they usually tell me how many drinks of coffee they have a day, and I kind of believe them. Mm-hmm. When the man asks about how much alcohol he drinks, it's usually underestimated by a factor. And we know that alcohol is related to atrial fibrillation when you drink way too much. So I suspect it could have been a lot more. I'm just saying.
Potentially.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters. It's about the high-calorie office snacks, which you call when you walk past the snack room and the break room and the workplace, and there's a lot of donuts and cake and other sorts of things there.
And healthy and not so healthy. So this is from the Food, Culture, and Society, an international journal of multidisciplinary research.
That's a hard journal to say.
It is. And looking at nutrition in the workplace, they actually had 25 office workers at the University of California, Davis, record what they ate and where they consumed that food during a 24-hour period. And then they were supposed to rate their choices in terms of goodness and health.
And perhaps not surprising, when you put in a lot of things in the workplace that are really hard to kind of walk past and not salivate, like maybe some donuts or cake, people tend to consume it because it's right there. They don't have much control necessarily.
Well, these are called unplanned offerings, or what they call the emergence of food altars, where people just come and bring what they don't want and dump it for anybody else to come by and pick up. So you may have brought a healthy lunch, but then you walk by and you see something a little bit more tempting, and maybe it's an hour before lunchtime and you're grabbing something that may even counteract what you're trying to do with your healthy lunch.
And one way of getting control back in that environment is they talk about putting water there. And I thought, what a great thing. That's what water fountains do, that's soothing. It gives this control back. I think we should encourage our workplaces to have more
drinking water. Was the one thing that, as they said, water is the way to deal with this and to help keep your temptations at bay.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Vivian Hsu, Senior Program Officer at the Program for Appropriate Technology and Health, about the global fight against cervical cancer. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. Today on Conversations, Carol, we're talking with Dr. Vivian Hsu, Associate Director of Reproductive Health at PATH, about the global fight against cervical cancer. Welcome, Dr. Hsu.
Thank you very much.
You know, you're an epidemiologist with expertise in HPV, and we're going to talk about all those different terms and reproductive health. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in these sorts of fields?
Well, it is a rather long journey, but I'll shorten it for you. I started out in African history and did a graduate degree in African history at Berkeley. And then my husband and I went to live in Kenya for a year. And while there, we were working on health issues. My husband is a scientist. And I became convinced that the pressing needs for Africa were in the health area. And when we came back to the United States, I went to public health school to try and learn how to address some of those needs. I ended up working here at PATH in the 1980s. And we had an epidemiologist from CDC who came and spoke to us about some of the health issues and talked about cervical cancer, which I hadn't given much thought to, hadn't heard much about as a global health problem. And he talked about how significant a problem it was, but that there didn't seem to be very many solutions for it. And shortly after that, about a year or so later, we came across an article by an American gynecologist who had found what he thought might be a simpler way to identify the precancer stage of cervical cancer. And that got us thinking about, was there something we could actually be doing about this really significant problem? And so that was 25 years ago, and we started working on cervical cancer then, and I have been working on it ever since, and the field has changed dramatically over those 25 years, and I think we are so much closer now to actually being able to make a huge difference.
And you recently published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about the human papilloma virus and cervical cancer. For our listeners, can you explain how this virus and cancer are related?
Yeah, Carol, I'm happy to do that. Human papilloma virus is a virus of which there are many types, more than 100 different types. And some of these, probably 30 or 40, affect the genital area. And of those, about 14 or 15 are considered high risk for causing cancer. And it's not just cervical cancer. It can cause other cancers of the genital area. And what some of your listeners may have heard more about is that it also causes head and neck cancers of different types. So we are concerned about the virus because we know that it is the essential cause of cervical cancer. Other things affect what happens. Not everybody who gets the virus gets cervical cancer, so we know there must be some intervening factors, but almost nobody gets the cancer who doesn't have some evidence that human papillomavirus was there. We've learned a lot more about this now since we had the vaccine that has come forward. Once we understood that the HPV was the cause of cervical cancer, then scientists were able to start working on a vaccine. And as many of our listeners probably know, 10 years ago, we had the first HPV vaccine introduced into the United States.
If I think back to my own medical training, and, you know, we were trained that pap smears were the way that we could help prevent cervical cancer, but it wasn't by all means even known then that HPV really you weren't going to get it if you weren't exposed. And then, of course, you just mentioned the vaccine out there. But your article really takes it to what it seems to me is the next evolution. You begin by saying no woman should die of cervical cancer in this day and age. Given that we're talking about a cancer, is that really true? And then if that's the case, why are women still dying close to 300,000 a year?
Well, it really is true that we can prevent almost all cervical cancer now, and that's through screening. In the U.S., we have seen something like a 80% or 90% drop in cervical cancer, as pap smears as one was one of the main reasons we were able to do that. So we are very lucky with cervical cancer that there's a precancerous stage that takes many years to develop, which gives us a big window of time in which to capture women who have this precancerous stage, which is very easy to treat. Now we also are going to be adding the vaccine in, and as we give vaccine to young generations of girls, they will be protected in the future. But that's 30 years into the future when they would have otherwise been potentially developing cervical cancer. But for women who are, as we argue in the paper, for women who are already beyond the age when the vaccine will be most effective, we need to screen them. And if we were to screen all these women, then we could prevent almost all the cervical cancer.
So that works here in the United States, but you're saying that it doesn't work so well in low and middle income countries. Why not? And what can we do in those countries to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer?
Right. It has been very effective here, but if we think about it, many of the women in your audience will know that they've had to go for screening every year, or now they've decided that probably every other year is sufficient. That's a lot of doctor visits. And even once you have a screening test done, PAP, it has to go off to a laboratory. It has to be read, made into a slide and read under the microscope by a pathologist who's had a lot of training. The results have to get back to the woman, presumably through her primary care physician or her gynecologist. Then if there's anything abnormal in her pap smear, she's asked to come back for another visit when they will take a magnifying instrument called a colposcope and take a closer look at her cervix. And if they still see something there that looks abnormal, they'll take a biopsy, a little piece of tissue, which will then be sent off to a pathologist to examine. And she may be called back for a third visit to get the results of her pathology, of her biopsy, and then be asked to arrange an appointment for treatment. So she may have four appointments and involve several different specialists and quite a few different pieces of expensive equipment. That system has not been able to be replicated in most low and middle income countries. So health systems that have lots of demands on them and very few resources have not been able to replicate that system. So we're looking at new approaches that have been developed over the last 20 years that could be easier to implement in low and middle income countries. And that's what we're calling for in the article, is to put those kind of systems in place and those resources in place.
So we're going to need to take a short break in a second, but I know when we come back, we'd really like to know, what are the types of systems you're talking about? How adaptable is that technology? What's the cost of that technology? Is it something that actually we should be doing in the United States and other higher income countries? And also, what is PATH, and how is it that it's in this leadership role with you co-leading it there? So we'll take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Vivian Sue, Associate Director of Reproductive Health at PATH, about the global fight against cervical cancer. You're listening to Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We've been talking to Dr. Vivian Hsu, Associate Director of Reproductive Health at PATH, about the global fight against cervical cancer. And right before the break, Dr. Hsu, you began to suggest, and you suggest in your article, that there's another approach that we should be doing in low and middle income countries, because we can't really reproduce this high-tech expensive approach that we maybe have done in places like the United States. Can you describe what that approach is?
Yes, Adam, I'm happy to do that. There are really two approaches, but one of that has been tested and developed over the last 15 or 20 years is called visual inspection with acetic acid. So it's shortened down to VIA, visual inspection, meaning that we look at the cervix, and that means doing an internal exam on women, just looking in with a light and looking for a change of color in the cervix after it's been swabbed with acetic acid, which is simple vinegar. That's a method that can be used at very simple levels. But more recently, we have found that doing an HPV test, a test for the presence of that human papillomavirus we were talking about before, that test is much more accurate than the subjective test of visual inspection. And we've learned recently that we could do that test with a sample that women collect themselves. So they use a little swab that's sort of like a tampon, and they take a swab from their vagina, and they can put that in a test tube. That then goes to a lab. The importance of a self-collected sample is that, one, it overcomes some of the cultural barriers in many of these societies of women who don't want to be examined by a male provider or even a female provider. It's something that goes against their culture. But it also addresses one of the serious problems we see in many, many low-income countries, is that there's a severe shortage of health workers. And doing this examination of any type, whether it's a pap smear or the visual examination, takes 15 or 20 minutes at least of a health worker's time. And by doing a self-collected sample, we can save that time and avoid the cultural issue and the embarrassment, and enable women to give in a sample that the lab can then test, which is much more accurate. So that approach, combined with some changes in the program strategy that we've been doing, instead of recommending, as we do here in North America or in Europe, testing every few years, we're recommending that countries that don't currently do anything should start out by testing women at least once in a lifetime, preferably in their 30s, because that's the age that's before cancer develops, but after this pre-cancer can develop. By doing testing once in a lifetime with a self-collected sample and providing treatment for those who have a positive test result, and using some updated kinds of treatment, and I can talk about that more in a second, by putting that package together, we can prevent at least half of the cervical cancer deaths just from that very basic package.
And all of that takes place in one visit?
Yes.
Wow.
No, the test result takes time to come back from the lab.
Okay.
So we need to develop good methods of reaching women with their test results. And this is the place where some other new technology, like mobile phones, cell phones, come into play as well. And we're currently just getting ready to start a test to see whether we can use an automated text message system to tell women to come back in for their results and their treatment. And it's amazing when we think about these societies that are still low income, and yet cell phones are everywhere. And we want to capture the use of that new technology to be in the service of this health approach as well. Now, we have to test that, because we want to make sure that messages that we send to women are safe for them to receive. Sometimes cell phones are shared with other family members, so we want to respect their privacy. And we also need to find out, do they have access to a cell phone? Do they need the message to be coded? If they get the message, how long will it take them to come back in? But this is a whole effort to put together the right combination of technology and program approaches to be affordable and sustainable for countries that have very limited resources available to them to try and take care of these health needs.
and an interesting combination between the low technology of having the woman do her own sample, bring it in, and the high technology with the cell phones.
Absolutely. And I think it's that combination that we're always looking for. This is a hallmark of how PATH works. We've been a leader in global health innovation, but it's never just the technology in isolation. It's the technology as part of a system, a health system. And all of those pieces have to go together to make it work.
So tell us for a minute, we've mentioned the word PATH a couple times. What exactly is it? And when you talk about, and you talk about in your article, that you need to really also build service delivery systems, give us a taste of what that actually means too.
Right. PATH is a nonprofit international health organization, and we focus particularly on improving health among women and children. And we have been around for almost 40 years. Next year is our 40th anniversary. And we started out being called Program for Appropriate Technology in Health, which is quite a mouthful. And over the years, we found it was easier to shorten our name to PATH. But appropriate technology was the focus of how we started. And the appropriate part means appropriate in all kinds of ways. Appropriate by cost, by culture, by health system fit. And that's where the health system and health delivery systems come into play. When we think of a technology, we can't think about it in isolation. And so service delivery is an important part. And here in the United States, for example, most people will have an individual primary care doctor, and that's who they go to initially. In a lot of low-income countries, health care is delivered by the government, and they have community clinics, and people go to those. They may pay something, or they may have a small fee, or it may be free. It depends on the particular government. But there are providers at that first level of care, the primary care clinic. It's rarely a doctor. It's usually a nurse or a nurse midwife or a clinical officer, somebody like our physician's assistant, for example. And so we have to think about moving skills down to the level of the kind of provider who is available. And thinking about all of those elements, we can't rely on sending out, you know, results from our test. Here in the U.S., if you get a pap smear, you get the result in the mail as well as to your doctor. We don't have postal delivery in a lot of these countries. They don't have the resources to have home delivery of mail service. So we have to be creative in thinking about how to overcome some of these areas, these obstacles. And that's part of the whole approach of innovation that we focus on.
And you've mentioned several challenges to dealing with this in terms of health, the number of healthcare providers and finding the right combination of high tech and low tech. Are there any other challenges that stop this disease from going the same way as polio?
There are two main challenges, I think. One is information. A lot of people are still not aware that so many women develop cervical cancer. It's more than 500,000 every year. Most people would be amazed to hear that because it's not a problem here in the U.S. or in Europe. Because of screening, we've mostly brought those numbers down very low. So awareness is one of the issues that is still holding us back. Even doctors in low-income countries, they were trained often in medical school programs that didn't talk about cervical cancer, that said our main problems are malaria, tuberculosis, HIV. They don't get a lot of information about cancer, even though it is starting to be a major problem in their countries. So information is one issue, but funding is definitely the other issue. And many of the countries rely on help and funding from external donors, the international donors we hear about that help out. The U.S. has, for example, a large foreign aid program, and there are global funders like the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria. But you hear what that focuses on, AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria. Mm-hmm. Those are the diseases we associate, and money that has not come forward for cancer as much. So countries need to put their own budget in, and they need help from their global funding partners.
And love that your emphasis is on women and children, which the underserved even globally.
Yes, and women and children are definitely the most vulnerable groups and the least likely to be able to have services that they need. There's been a lot of attention to children's health over the last 20 years, 30 years, and as a result, we're seeing real progress in reduction of childhood mortality. But we need to do the same thing to help women. And there's, again, been a lot of progress in helping women during the time of pregnancy and childbirth. That got the world's attention and got a lot of significant support, and it made a difference. And we think the same difference could be made with cervical cancer if it got the same kind of support.
Well, we know that there's a huge couple of foundations out in the Washington area that we hope that if they're listening, we have program officers out there, they can and fund, if they're not already, really take this up. And I guess just maybe about 15 seconds, if you could leave our listeners with one final thought about anything we've discussed today, what would it be, Dr. Sue?
Well, I think it's important to for the listeners to understand that we have learned a lot about cervical cancer in the last 30 years. We didn't know the cause before. We didn't have a vaccine before. We have a lot of tools at hand now, and we should use that both here at home and overseas. Here at home to get people to protect ourselves, to make sure our daughters are vaccinated, that women we care about get screened, but also to support any efforts that people are involved in that help get health care out to women and girls in less advantaged countries.
Well, we want to thank you for your advocacy, your research, your leadership, a trip that began perhaps somewhat innocuously on that first trip to Africa, but certainly is now making a difference for millions of women across the globe. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking with Dr. Vivian Sue, Associate Director of Reproductive Health at PATH, about the global fight against cervical cancer. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Carol and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Carol, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address in an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today, something to do with diabetes and blood sugar.
The first House Call question is, I am an Asian American man in my early 30s and a non-smoker. I was surprised a few years ago when my doctor told me that my blood sugar and A1C levels were borderline pre-diabetic, even though I exercised fairly regularly and was only slightly overweight. Since then, I've made several lifestyle changes, including exercise nearly every day, and have lost 30 pounds. However, the last time I had labs done, my A1C was still elevated, although my glucose had lowered to the normal range. Do you have any advice?
I think we'll have some advice, Carol.
Well,
we always
Adam,
have
why
advice.
Don't you first of all explain what an A1C is?
An A1C, which that's how we abbreviate it, and it's just like that. It's the capital A, a 1, and a capital C, and we associate that with what's called a hemoglobin A1C, and that's a special type of hemoglobin in the bloodstream that goes elevated with blood sugars become elevated. And so it can give you an average 3-month blood sugar reading. Rather than people necessarily having to stick their finger 3-4 times a day and seeing the blood sugar elevated, it lets us know. And typically in most health systems around the world, a hemoglobin A1C less than 6, or depending on the measurement, less than 7, certainly less than 5, depending on where your cutoff is considered normal. And when it's elevated, that would give you a 3-month blood sugar that's high. And so if you had a hemoglobin A1C of 10 or 12 or 14, that would be very high. What do you think, Carol, about someone who still is losing weight, but their A1C is elevated? And what kind of things just come to mind?
Well, it sounds to me like he's making a lot of good lifestyle changes already. And that sometimes are there drug interactions, Adam, that can increase A1C? Are, is this particular, the, he says he's Asian American. Are there different cultural levels of A1C? Is there, is that even ever been studied?
Yeah. I think these are great questions. And these are the sorts of questions we would think about clinically in the examination room. We'd want to know, well, what is going on? Because most typically excess weight is related to insulin not being sensitive, which then causes some of the diabetic changes to come about. And I guess I find it interesting here is that the A1C was still elevated, but the blood sugar had come down. Now, sometimes remember that A1C is a three-month average. So if you've lost that 30 pounds, but it's happened over 1 or 2 months, it'll take another 2 months later to see the full impact of that. So I bet that A1C has actually come down, though it's not normal, even though the actual blood sugars are normal. So
maybe being retested in a couple months?
Yeah, that sounds quite reasonable. There's really no reason to recheck a hemoglobin A1C until 3 months after the first one, because again, whatever changes you make are going to take 3 months, and even then it may take a few more. So while I think there could be some drugs at play, I think we're on the right track here.
All right.
What's our very next house call, Laura?
I'm a man in my early 40s. I've been a smoker since my late teens and have tried to quit on several occasions. I even went 6 months without smoking at one point, but every time I've fallen back into old habits at some point. I want to model good behavior for my kids and, of course, live a healthier lifestyle. I haven't had a cigarette in 2 weeks, but it's hard. How can I keep from falling back into those old habits?
Well, you're with the expert here, because we have the director of the University of North Carolina's Nicotine Dependence Program right here, Carol.
And first of all, congratulations for that you have quit for 6 months and that now you have quit again for 2 weeks. That is no small feat. And you've referred several times to habits. And yeah, there are habits that have become associated with your smoking, but smoking is also a very powerful addiction. And so the difficulty that you're experiencing may have to do with the kind of symptoms of craving and the memories that you have that have been associated with smoking for as many years as you have at this point. One of the things we will recommend right away is that you consider some form of medication to support you.
That seems quite reasonable. And any long-term tip to avoid relapse?
Remembering, first of all, you've got all these wonderful, wonderful reasons, being a good role model for your kids, living a healthier lifestyle, keeping those right in front of you, reminding yourself of all the good things you enjoyed, even when you think back about that 6 months when you didn't smoke. What were some things you really enjoyed about that time and liked about that? Keeping that in the forefront of your thoughts can help as well. And remember that the medications don't make you quit. They support you so that you can work on creating that lifestyle that you're aiming for, that healthy lifestyle. Less about quitting smoking and more about becoming the person you want to be.
Perfect answer. Laura, what's your last house call?
I'm in my late 70s and I work with children. It seems like every fall and winter, I come down with one illness after another as the kids share germs. Is there anything I can do at this point in the year to better protect myself or boost my immune system?
I'm not in my late 70s, but my granddaughter is 16 months old, and I remember last winter, first time, we kept sharing illnesses back and forth around the whole family.
Yeah, I strongly recommend that you have good wipes around and use those disinfectants and try to avoid. We know that hand washing makes a big difference, and hand washing for the kids as well, particularly if people have colds. To kind of do that, flu shots, other ways of boosting your immune system, a healthy diet, enough sleep. We know sleep is a huge motivator of immune system. Lots of things. We could probably do a whole show about boosting our immune system. Some people believe in vitamins. We're not going to go into it right now.
Vitamin C?
We're not going to go into it right now. But thank you so much for your questions, and thank all of our listeners today for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our great guest today, Dr. Vivian Sue, and I'd like to thank my co-host today, Carol Ripley Moffitt. We hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Carol Ripley Moffitt.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.